Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast number 34 for Tuesday, January 26th. I'll be your host this week. My name is David O'Brien, and with me...
Dominic Rabe.
Ben Snakehoff.
And David Liu.
As usual, we have three stories for you this week, including the FBI and warrantless wiretapping and some new information that just popped up, and two similar cases, both involving the copyright infringement trials that happened over the last 2 years, including the Jamie Thomas case and the Joel Tenenbaum case. So diving right into it, an interesting story popped up on our radar this week, came out of an article in the Washington Post, and it concerns the FBI and warrantless wiretapping. In particular, warrantless wiretapping that was going on between the years of 2002 and 2006. According to the article, which apparently gets this information from an anonymous source, more than 2,000 U.S. phone calls were recorded illegally in violation of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which is something that we'll discuss a little bit. And this information pops up sort of after an investigation has been going on into the warrantless wiretapping inquiries that have been going on for the last several years, as a matter of fact. And a lot of people associate this, of course, with the past administration that was in the White House. Anyone have any initial thoughts before we dive into the law and why this is important?
My first question is, I thought this had to do with phone records and not specifically wiretapping, as opposed to the NSA cases that were also in the news recently. Was I reading the article wrong?
No, actually, that's a great point, because there are sort of two separate cases which are going on in parallel, and they both sort of invoke the same areas of law, and this might just be one of those cases of me getting a little foggy in the head. But the initial report which came out in the Washington Post did concern call records and not actual wiretaps, but both are subject to similar laws, and in particular, I guess, there's a big difference between tapping live phone calls and just getting call records from concerning the which numbers have called other people and how a government agency can go about doing that, because you have to go through a third party like one of the telephone operating companies. So people are really concerned about their privacy, and the EFF wrote a pretty scathing post on this too. And it's been the subject of several lawsuits. In particular, there's this law out there called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. Does one of you want to talk a little bit about what that is?
It's a pretty broad act, and it's huge. I tried to go through to familiarize myself with it, but there are a lot of provisions. Mostly what the act concerns is wiretapping and what it takes for the federal government to get permission to wiretap and what punishments there are for people who commit wiretaps. However, the Electronic Communication Privacy Act, or ECPA, also deals with certain other stored communications, like telephone records or something that's on a server somewhere.
So normally in a case where you have a government agency who's doing some sort of presumably criminal inquiry into a domestic household or into the call records that come out of a domestic household, you need a warrant. And we've talked about this pretty recently too, so I think we could just give a quick rundown on why it is that you need a warrant.
The Fourth Amendment of the Constitution provides that citizens will be free from unreasonable search or seizures unless there's a warrant involved. So the presumption is that any search done by a government is invalid unless there's a warrant. There are actually a lot of exceptions to that, and we don't have time to go into all of them. But generally, you need a warrant to get what would otherwise be private information.
Right, and probably some of the exceptions that people are at least a little bit familiar with are, or one of them is certainly if a government agent spots some sort of contraband that's out in the open air where they can visibly see it, at that point they do not need to have a warrant in order to conduct the search.
So long as they're lawfully on the grounds there. It's the in plain view doctrine.
Correct, and as we noted, there's a lot of nuances to some of these circumstances in which you don't need a warrant. In particular, though, how this impacts the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, or just ECPA, is that there are certain exigent circumstances built into ECPA. Is that correct?
I believe there are. I was going through the act. So there are two parts of it. There's ECPA, and there's also the Privacy Protection Act, which is part of ECPA, but it's a little different. There are these exigencies. What they are specifically, I was having trouble nailing down. It's a very long and complicated act.
So, you know, that's something that struck me about this, too, is that these are huge acts, and they actually have, like, subparts which have their own titles to them, just like you mentioned. And I think what the one that concerns this case has to do with something that came out of the Patriot Act, which was a separate promulgation after ECPA, and it basically modified some of the warrant requirements within ECPA in order to get certain types of records where you would otherwise need a warrant. And what it did is it built in sort of this system where a government agency, if there is some sort of imminent need in order to get the records, for example, if they thought that there was going to be some sort of act of terrorism, they didn't want this particular law to sort of delay the process of tracking down that terrorist. And if they got the right signatures on certain national security letters, which is a little device which basically says that somebody has the authority to go in and claim that there is an exigent circumstance in place, then they can go in and get those records. So what was interesting of this is that it seems that the FBI was really liberally construing those requirements that you need to get the exigent circumstances under ECPA, and it seems that in between the years of 2002 and 2006, there were some 2,000 people which had their records at least searched by the FBI, and I think the article also noted that some of the authorizations were done on sticky notes, too. Did you, any of you guys catch that?
Yeah, I also like the fact that the FBI, after they had done these, they'd taken these records without authorization, they went back and tried to justify it post hoc, saying, we're going to okay this after the fact, which it turns out isn't really legal.
Right. I mean, go ahead.
I was just going to say, the thing I thought was interesting that this sort of terrorism exception existed before 9/11 and the Patriot Act, but with the introduction of the Patriot Act, it sort of lowered the bar in some sense, allowing for lower level officials to be able to authorize this. But there was still this, the request had to be tied to an open terrorism case. So they couldn't just randomly use these authorizations, they had to actually be able to tie it to some sort of threat that was going on that they were investigating. And from the way I was reading it was that, they were getting these records from the phone companies under the process, that seemed legal, but they never followed up with the actual paperwork that would link it to open terrorism cases. And their refusal to provide that is actually what the problem was, that if they're not going to provide it, then the authorization was invalid.
So some good points in there. And, this has become a bit of a political issue because it relates so closely to the past administration. And, of course, that's not really a topic that we usually hit on our show here, so we can probably do pretty well with staying away from it. But just given the general nature of privacy, how do you guys feel about hearing the FBI is sort of taking shortcuts and they're able to basically obtain records that they would otherwise need warrants for?
I don't think it's particularly surprising that they're able to do this. Any social engineer worth his salt could probably call up a phone company and work his or her way into getting these records. I guess what worries me is that there's really nothing that we can do about it as citizens. the Washington Post has said they don't know whose records were taken. They don't have any of that information. And according to the FBI, they've stopped this practice. So there's really nothing as citizens that we can do other than be angry that will actually prevent the FBI from having done this or from doing it again in the future.
But the question I think that is sort of pertinent here is that, I mean, this was something that was done illegally. Is one thing that someone could do is press charges against someone in the FBI.
So one thing I'm not clear about on reading the story is exactly what did the FBI do that is illegal here?
They got phone records, and they didn't do it pursuant to the statute through which they were supposed to get phone records.
And the way they were supposed to get it was with a national security letter.
Either with a warrant or with a national security letter. And if they were going to do it through a warrant, they would have to prove, you know, that they needed the records and that the activities that they were trying to investigate fell within certain enumerated criminal acts. Can I hit on Dave Liu's point for a second?
Yeah, go for it.
One of the problems with pressing charges is that what the FBI may have done isn't necessarily criminal, and if you try to go after them in civil court for monetary, you know, damages, you're going to have a lot of difficulty, both because you'll have to get around what's called governmental immunity. If the FBI people are doing this and it's within the scope of what they're doing and it wasn't clearly unconstitutional and there are some other little ins and outs there, you're going to have a very difficult time recovering against anybody. And you're also going to have to prove that you were somehow harmed by that. And right now, we don't have any names of people who were actually affected by these telephone record searches.
So does anyone want to play devil's advocate on why we might want to allow the FBI to have greater access to this type of information?
I guess I'm going to just elaborate on my point a little bit here, and that I guess it's that the national security letter, one of the two avenues open to them, the warrant obviously taking even longer than an NSL, the national security letter was taking too long, so they sent these exigent circumstances letters that said, hey, there's an emergency, we need you to disclose your records, please. And then after the fact, they would send a national security letter after they got the information, sort of as a cover your rear appendage for the phone companies. Like, it seems like they're trying to go through protocol, except for they're not, because they're sending off these letters and then sending off the national security letters after they already have the information.
Well, right.
You go, Dave.
Certainly sounds like they didn't do things in the right order, but that, in the end, it's still non-compliance with the statute.
Right, and the other thing was they didn't always even send out the exigency letters. They didn't always, you know, even try to prove that there was an ongoing investigation and it was an emergency. Sometimes they just called up and pressured the people into releasing the letter, the information.
You know, I have to say, if I was put in a position on working for one of the telephone companies, and if I got a call from the FBI, I would probably take it pretty seriously, and if the guy was convincing enough on the other end of the phone and he said that you need to release these records, you know, I could certainly see an employee, you know, giving out those records under those circumstances. But again, does anyone here think that there should be any reason why the FBI might want to have greater access without these sort of checkpoints through the statute of having to get letters and authorizations in order to search records?
I mean, I think the key point here is that they did get the information. So, I mean, if you want to give the horribly cliche, you know, Jack Bauer situation, you know, they got the information they needed and, you know, they could therefore prevent the terrorist threat. But they didn't, I mean, doing so assumes that, you know, as boring as it sounds, that the follow-up paperwork would be filed to tie it to a terrorist threat. And, I mean, if I were in that situation as the phone company employee, you know, yeah, I would hand over those records, but I would assume that they were doing so legally and would be able to back it up with evidence later on, if nothing else.
Well, I suppose, just to play devil's advocate for a moment, without having ever worked at a government agency, anything like the FBI, and not really being aware of what the bureaucracy levels are in order for what it takes to get the right authorizations in order to conduct these types of searches, I can't really say how difficult it is and how encumbering the or how cumbersome the statute might be with placing restrictions on how you need to go about getting certain information, but at the same time, I might be willing to recognize at least a little bit that given the state of affairs today in the world, where we constantly have terrorist attacks, not just in the U.S., but in other places, or at least have the constant threat here in the U.S. of another terrorist attack, it is at least possible that the FBI might want to be able to quickly access that information that they're looking for. Now, the statute, as I read it, it doesn't seem to be terribly hard in order to get the right authorizations, as long as, you know, they go through the right channels of communication in the FBI or for whatever they need to get an NSL. But at the same time, though, you know, maybe it is the case that they needed to speed up the process a little bit. Hard to say.
It seems like what the FBI's chief violation here is that they made up circumstances that weren't emergencies and said they were, for the purposes of being able to send out the exigent circumstance. And that itself, like, if you look at the statute, that is an exception. Like, the phone providers are allowed to disclose the telephone records to the government if they have a good faith belief that there's an emergency involving danger of death or serious bodily injury that requires disclosure without delay of information with relation to the emergency. So, and that exception is there for that sort of Jack Bauer ticking time bomb scenario. The problem is that the FBI is just using that exception as a expedient instead of an exigent circumstance.
Good point. So, any final thoughts before we move on?
I'm all set.
All set. I'm going to close with, the argument that this is really a technical violation, not so much a privacy one, in that, sure, they're violating the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law gives them access to this information in the first place. It's just they didn't exactly follow all the protocols that they should have had to do so.
I think that's assuming that there is, that the expedient circumstances, you know, the terrorist threat is actually true. I mean, I think a lot of the concern with this case is that, you know, maybe it wasn't a terrorist threat, but, you know, some sort of political or otherwise motivated made-up scenario in order to get those phone records. And without the evidence to back that up, it's hard to say which it is.
Yeah, that is the scary scenario, but unfortunately we have absolutely no way of knowing right now whether that is the case. I hope it's not.
It's tough just because it's difficult to have the level of transparency you might expect from certain branches of the government within an agency like the FBI, just because the nature of their work, it just tends to be very secretive, and obviously if they disclosed absolutely everything, they would have no secrets, and the people that they would are trying to track down might be able to use that against them at some point. So, in any event, we'll just have to keep our eyes on it. And another good point that you made, Dominic, that is probably worth noting, is that if the telephone companies were operating under a good faith belief that the FBI did in fact have the authorization to obtain those records, that there's no liability really there, assuming there was good faith. So the liability, if any, in this case, and has been pointed out, it's somewhat tenuous, would fall on the FBI, but then again, we don't exactly know what records they did have. I think the one report which has been released concerning, this actually might have concerned the NSA stuff, but of course it was heavily redacted, so even the people that were being searched don't know, so it's kind of difficult to file a lawsuit like that, but there are, of course, the major institutions like the EFF who monitor this stuff constantly and also file lawsuits constantly based on these perceived or actual privacy violations. So, moving on to our next two stories, which are very closely related but still very interesting, we're going to start with this Jamie Thomas case. We had some new news come up in it. And as you may recall, Jamie Thomas has had sort of it's actually Jamie Thomas Rassett, has had a very troubled time in the court system. She was, of course, the woman from Minnesota who was found guilty of violating copyright law when she downloaded 24 songs, or at least the 24 songs were at issue in the case. It eventually went to trial, and she got a guilty verdict. The verdict was eventually overturned based on a bad jury instruction that the judge gave, but the jury, before it was overturned, I believe the jury had awarded $222,000 worth of damages based on the copyright infringement of those 24 songs. A new trial then came out of it, and with a new jury, I believe. And again, she was found guilty, but this time circumstances were a little bit different, and the damages for those 24 songs resulted in $1.92 million against her. So Jamie Thomas Rasset then filed what we call a motion for a remitur, or also a motion for a new trial, which those two motions actually go simultaneously. I'm sure Ben could explain those a little bit further. He tends to be our expert on those types of post-verdict procedural matters. And remitur basically asks for a reduction in damages. And so post-verdict, after the jury has already determined that she is guilty and the damages were assessed at $1.92 million, the judge came back and reduced those damages. And that came out this week. So do you have any thoughts on this? Ben, first, you want to actually add any remitur technical stuff for us?
Yeah, sure. So I've always pronounced it remitter, but Dave, you and I always disagree on how to actually pronounce things, so, and it doesn't really matter. But essentially what happens is after the trial comes down, the verdict comes down in this case, Jamie Thomas's lawyer, in this case Kiwi Kamara, who we've talked about before, he filed a motion that says you either need to reduce the verdict because it's absurdly huge, or you need to grant us a new trial. And in this case, the there were also some other claims thrown in there, claims about why a new trial was justified, and that the statutory damages provision were unconstitutional, but I think we're going to address that more a little later. So in this case, we've got this motion for remitter, and the judge granted it. And now the ball is essentially in the RIAA's court. What they can do now is they can either accept the lower verdict down to, I think it's about $54,000 from $1.92 million. They can appeal immediately, or they can ask for a new trial. What they can't do is ask for a new trial or accept the lower verdict and then appeal the judge's decision. That's not an option here.
Right, and so we should first probably point out what the statutory damages are under the Copyright Act. And provided if a plaintiff, that is the copyright holder who is suing somebody for copyright infringement, registered their copyright before the time of infringement, they're eligible for a section under the Copyright Act, which is the statutory damages section. And it lays out sort of a scheme for damages, and on the low end, what it does is, if the jury does come back with a guilty verdict, they can then assess damages based on sort of a spectrum. And on the low end, the spectrum starts at, I think, $750. And on the high end, it's $150,000. That's per instance of infringement. So in this case, we had 24 songs which were at issue. And the second trial where we had the guilty verdict, the jury came back with $80,000 per infringement, kind of right in the middle of that spectrum. And after the remitter, if you prefer, it was reduced down to $2,250. Now, a number of people have sort of suggested that there might be a constitutional challenge based on the statutory damages provision in the Copyright Act. And so the judge granted the remitur and reduced the damages from what was $80,000 per infringement, so $80,000 for each song that was which was infringed upon, down to $2,250. What factors did the judge consider when he issued this opinion?
He considered a lot of things. He first spent a fair amount of time talking about what the actual damages were to the recording industry, and he came down kind of wishy-washy here. You know, the damages weren't $1 per song, and it wasn't even, you know, $15 or $20 per song if you wanted to say the damages were the cost of an entire album as opposed to just the single on the iTunes Music Store, some other store like that, because there was lost profit. There was also the chance that people could have downloaded the song that Jamie Thomas was sharing in her own file. But on the flip side of that, you know, the damage is nowhere near probably $750, but they're hard to pin down. And the judge also looked at the fact that Jamie Thomas never took, never fessed up to the fact that she committed this copyright infringement, and she went from the first trial saying that, yeah, I had nothing to do with this, I have no idea what's going on, to in the second trial she was blaming her boyfriend and possibly her children for putting the file sharing software on her computer, and that should weigh against her. The judge also considered the fact that these were registered copyrights before the date of infringement, so that there should be some, for one, there was willful infringement, and there should be some extra quantum of damage for that.
So a lot of people get upset when they hear about this particularly large award for copyright infringement, because it really just involved 24 songs, and I think that was something that Jamie Thomas had raised in her motion, and there were two interesting ratios that she came out with, and she said if you can assume that the song's value on the internet was $1.29, for instance, if you bought it on iTunes, or if you bought the album as a whole, about $15 an album, in the first instance for $1.29 for the song, the damages then are 62,000 times more than the actual damages that the plaintiffs would have incurred based on her infringement. And in the case of the $15 per album, it was about 5,000, still about 5,300 or so times more than the actual damages that, if you calculated them that way. So why then do the statutory damages not just apply what the actual damages were? Why doesn't she just owe $15 or $1.29 per infringement?
Because statutory damages serve the extra purpose of punishment and deterrence. The idea is that if we have these high damages, yes, this one person has to pay more, but the result is that people down the road won't infringe.
So does anyone here see this as a huge blow to the RIAA's campaign against copyright infringement?
I don't think it's going to slow them down much. I mean, they'll just hope for better luck in the next case. But that's just personal opinion, not really legal opinion.
The problem with that is that there really isn't a next case. The only other case that's, to the best of my knowledge, still pending, or at least still pending and has gotten any press, is the Tenenbaum case, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. The RIAA has said that they're going to stop suing individuals. They've still got a handful of cases pending in district courts, but my guess is most people are going to settle out of those now that they've seen these. The only way it's a big blow to the RIAA, in my view, is that they went from a $1.92 million verdict that they're not going to be able to collect to a $54,000 verdict that they're probably not going to be able to collect.
Right, so another great point. Jamie Thomas was a single mother who was not making a whole lot of money, and there was no way that, or at least no perceivable way, without, say, winning the lottery or coming into a lot of money, that she was going to be able to pay the $1.92 million. What happens in those cases when a defendant who gets a guilty verdict can't pay?
Your choices there are really limited. You can try to settle for something less than that, or when the person inevitably declares bankruptcy, you can hope that the bankruptcy judge gives you, you know, a chunk of whatever estate is left. But there's not a whole lot you can do.
So, this doesn't really seem to be a gigantic blow to the whole RIAA campaign, given something that we've discussed on a previous episode, and that's not too long ago, the RIAA made an announcement that they were no longer going to be suing individuals. There was some sort of speculation that that wasn't entirely true and that they were still filing new suits, but there was also reports to the contrary that those suits had to do with previous instances of infringement, not instances of infringement that were going forward after the announcement. But there is something to be said, though, that I guess the shock value of a $1.92 million verdict against a defendant is sort of lost here, considering it's been reduced down to $50,000. Anyone have any thoughts on whether the RIAA is going to try to go for the new trial?
I have no idea. It's a tough decision to make. The biggest risk of doing a new trial, well, first, it's just a trial on damages, so it's going to be a little easier than the last trial, but the risk is that you do that new trial, the jury comes back with another huge verdict, and the judge just reduces it again. At that point, you know, there's not much you can do. If I were them, I'd just say accept it, but you know, you never know. They may have a broader strategy than that.
So probably the next interesting component that comes out of this case, and it ties in nicely to our next story too, is that a lot of legal scholars have suggested, and practitioners too, that there's going to be a constitutional challenge to the statutory damages provision of the Copyright Act. In particular, you know, people are concerned that the statutory damages just really don't match up very well to what the actual damages are in terms of if you download one file, you know, how much does a copyright owner really lose? Is it just the 99 cents or the $1.29 that you would have paid on iTunes? Or is it really the bottom line or the bottom end of the spectrum at $750 for that song? Or is it the high end of that $150,000 per song? And so the next case involves just the second case that ever went to trial based on copyright infringement, and that was the Joel Tenenbaum case, and that was one that occurred here in Boston just over the summer in July, and Joel Tenenbaum was accused of infringing, I believe it was, 30 songs, and he went to trial with it, and mid-trial, basically, and this was something we covered on our podcast, while on the stand, he was asked directly if he had downloaded the songs, and up to that point he'd sort of skirted away from answering that question, and basically what he said on the stand was that I did in fact download those songs. And it's always an issue of fact when you have a copyright infringement case of whether the person that's actually being accused of infringement was the same person that actually did the infringement, because if you have a computer that's set up, say, in your dorm room, like Joel Tenenbaum might have had, you might have people constantly coming in and out of your room that might use your computer, and they might be the ones who go onto the peer-to-peer networks and download the songs onto your computer. And in those instances, you might have a colorable defense under the law that you weren't the person who actually did the infringement. And so once he had admitted that on the stand, basically saying that he lied during the depositions that occurred during discovery, the discovery phase of the litigation, the plaintiffs in the case then filed for what's known as a directed verdict, and directed verdict basically says, well, if there's are no more issues of fact, if the defendant has, like he has in this case, admitted that he was the one that downloaded the songs, and all other things are true in the case, meaning that the songs that we are accusing him of downloading were in fact downloaded, then he's guilty of copyright infringement. And Judge Gertner, who was presiding over the case, granted the motion, and then the issue of damages went to the jury, and based on that same statutory damages scheme that we just talked about with the spectrum that you can apply, they awarded the plaintiffs in that case $675,000, or about $22,500 per instance of infringement. So just like Jamie Thomas did in her case where she filed a motion for a new trial or a remitteur, Joel Tenenbaum has also filed one in his case. And this has drawn the attention, of course, of various interested groups, and including the Department of Justice, who came forward and submitted a brief basically defending the statutory damages award. And also worth noting, within his motion, Tenenbaum has started to argue that the statutory damages provision is not constitutional. So before we get into like a little bit about what the DOJ was arguing in their motion, maybe one of you can give a rundown on why it might be the case that the statutory damages provisions of the Copyright Act are not constitutional.
I've touched on this, I think, at least once before on the podcast. Essentially, the the argument goes like this. The Supreme Court has held that in cases where there are punitive damages, and a punitive damage is essentially like, let's say I'm in a car crash with David O'Brien, and he breaks the fender off of my car. It's totally his fault, by the way. I'm not at fault at all for that car crash. So there was $500 worth of damage to my car. So my compensatory damages in that case, when I eventually prevail in court, will be $500. But I say he was, you know, very reckless, and that he deserves to be punished in order to dissuade him and other people from driving that recklessly in the future. In that case, I can try to go for punitive damages, and those basically serve the same process, the same purpose as statutory damages. They're for deterrence and retribution. So the Supreme Court has previously held that in cases where there are punitive damages, they have to bear some relation to the actual harm caused. Generally, the rule is punitive damages can't be more than about 10 times what the compensatory damages in a case are. In this case, the argument is the actual damages, in this case what compensatory damages would be, are somewhere between $1 and $20 per song. And even if you multiply that by 10, that's a maximum of about $200 a song, not the $750 minimum statutory damage or the $80,000 that we've seen as the maximum in the second Jamie Thomas trial.
So, another little thing to point out that's really important is the fact that actual damages are not the same thing as punitive damages, and those are not the same thing as statutory damages. Those are three distinct concepts when you go into the rationale behind damages. And actual sound like exactly what they are. If say if the song was worth $1.29 to the record industry, then I would be liable for $1.29 because that was the harm that they suffered based on my one instance of infringement. And if you have a punitive damages scheme, like you well said, you stated pretty well, Ben. By the way, I am I'm a great driver, and I never get into car accidents. And if you have the punitive damages scheme, then it's all about punishing and a little bit of retribution, and it's about deterring people in the future from committing similar acts. And finally, you have the statutory damages schemes, which are entirely different than the actual or the punitive, and it's based on the statute which has been enacted by Congress, and Congress has specified that the dollar amount for copyright infringement, should you have a registered copyright before the infringement incurred, is it within the spectrum of $750,000 to $150,000. So, based on that, though, it's going to be interesting to see how a court, and first of all, if this court in particular addresses the constitutional issue. I think to this point, no courts really have, although some have said maybe we'll hear the arguments, but they haven't actually decided them on the merits. And it'll be interesting to see if they do, in fact, hear the argument out and address it on its merits, and whether or not we might see some change based on the way that damages are calculated in copyright infringement cases.
Yeah, on that note, Jamie Thomas actually raised a lot of these same arguments in her brief. What the judge did there is he said, well, I'm going to reduce the verdict anyway, so I'm not going to reach these constitutional arguments. And it's possible that Judge Gertner may do the same thing, try to avoid this constitutional issue, because that's actually a doctrine courts have. If they can avoid invalidating a law or even addressing the constitutional implications of a law, they're going to do that, because constitutional issues are kind of thorny.
It seems like a pretty tall order for a court to go about redesigning the scheme of copyright damages when it's been legislated by Congress. It's been legislated, it's been voted on, it's been approved by both houses and signed into law by the president. So there's usually a pretty strong presumption based on that something like a statutory damages scheme is going to stay in place.
Right, and that's one of the problems. While punitive damages have been held to violate what's called the Due Process Clause, That's never been the case with statutory damages. I don't think there's ever been a case where a statutory damage award has been overturned as unconstitutional.
So, the Department of Justice, of course, filed its brief, and as you might expect, they argued against every single aspect of what Tenenbaum raised, essentially. And the case law gets pretty complicated, and it's we don't want to get too deep into it, but there's a couple of cases which Ben noted apply to these punitive damages provisions, and the Department of Justice basically said that they don't apply, number one, or if they do apply, they all aspects of due process have been satisfied under the Supreme Court cases. So it's a little too early to tell what the judge is going to do, obviously, but he'll have the same options available to him that he had, or I'm sorry, Judge Gertner will have the same options available to her as did the judge in the Jamie Thomas case. So we'll have to see then if a remittor is in fact granted. And while considering these remittors, the judges look to see if there's an instance where there are substantially higher damages that are awarded than actual damages. And something that the judge in the Jamie Thomas case noted that he wasn't willing to take the per instance infringement calculation of damages all the way down to the 750. If you recall, he set it at $2,250 per infringement, and he said that this is three times the amount of the lowest amount of statutory damage you can have. And the as is very clear within the statutory language, the these are intended to be fairly punitive-like damages in the way that they're supposed to deter other people from committing acts of copyright infringement. So we'll have to wait and see what Judge Gertner does with this, and if in fact the remittor to reduce the damages is granted. And does anyone else have any other thoughts on the issue of damages, car accidents, or copyright infringement?
I'm all set.
I think you guys have done a great job.
Well, another interesting case, like I said, we'll keep our eye on it, and of course you can either expect a blog post on the Tenenbaum case or a follow-up on one of our next podcasts. So thanks for listening this week. I was your host. My name is David O'Brien, and with me,
Dominic Rabier,
Ben Snitkov,
and Dave Blue.
Please check out our website at technicallylegal.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at @techlegal, or send us an email at podcast@technicallylegal.org. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week.